What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, maybe you just don't know who to ask. Well, you can ask us and we'll give you the inside skinny here on that. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. Or you can text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief message. Message and data rates may apply. If you're watching us on TV today, you can participate as well. Here's our email address for that, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Rich Jesse handles social media for us. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, and that'll find its way to us here on the program. Again, the number 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you?
Doing very well. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Interesting question here from Denny, who says, my wife is discerning between Catholicism and Lutheranism. She likes the Catholic service more and most of the beliefs, but she doesn't believe in all the dogmas and can't go before the Lord and profess it all to become a Catholic. So far, these are the three big beliefs I want to confront her with before she makes that final decision. Number one, faith alone. Two, Bible only. Three, the difference in the Eucharist. Are there any other Lutheran beliefs I should talk to her about? And again, that's from Denny.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, you know, one thing that someone who's contemplating Catholicism really has to deal with when they say, well, you know, I believe this, 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 and this about the Catholic faith, but I don't know if I can believe that. If the discernment is between, say, Catholicism and Protestantism, and a kind of traditional form of Protestantism where they take the authority of the Bible seriously, I want you to consider what someone who is adopting Protestantism as a religion is committing themselves to. So Protestantism holds that the Bible is the rule of faith, meaning that everything that the Bible positively affirms is to be believed by Christians. Most people who enter the Christian faith probably have not even read the entire Bible cover to cover. Most haven't. I mean, some do, of course, but most haven't. So right off the bat, if you are pre-committing yourself to believe everything the Bible teaches, you're saying in advance, I trust everything the Bible says, even though I don't actually know what it says, right? Let's say you have read it all the way through. Well, for most people who have read the Bible all the way through, the Bible contains any number of difficulties. I mean, it contains a lot of passages that are deeply at tension with one another, as well as others that, let's just say, put it plainly, are quite counterintuitive, given what we might think about the character of God or the nature of justice. I mean, you know, take a few points at just random, like the sacrifice of Isaac, Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. Catholics believe in that too, but it ain't easy to wrap your head around. And there are many other passages like that you can come up with in the Old Testament, New Testament, as well, that present conundra at first blush for rational analysis. And again, the typical Protestant attitude is, well, you know, I hadn't got it all figured out yet. I'm not exactly sure how that plays to get God's justice, God's mercy. You know, I don't have all that stuff worked out, but God has it worked out somehow. So I'm going to just commit myself to the thing, trusting that either I'll figure it out later down the road or God has it all figured out. And it's enough for me just to believe the Bible, take it on faith. Right.
Yeah.
So in other words, the idea that you're going to commit to stuff that's not fully rationally intelligible to you, wherever you land religiously, you're going to have some kind of implicit faith wherever you decide the buck stops. You know, if the buck stops at the Bible, you've got to make an act of implicit faith in the Bible. If the buck stops at the teaching of the Catholic Church, you're going to have to make an act of implicit faith in the teaching of the Catholic Church. So the attitude that, you know, I'm 80% there on understanding the dogmas of the Catholic faith, but there are 20% of doctrines that don't make sense to me. Not being Catholic is not going to alleviate that existential uncertainty, right? And even if you remain an atheist or an agnostic, you're still left with those kind of sort of existential conundra, things that are not going to make sense about reality, and yet you keep trucking on with reality, right? Even though it's not all fully intelligible to you. So don't let the fact that you don't have it all figured out yet keep you back from the Catholic faith. That's not going to solve that problem for you. And, you know, the Catholic attitude is that you take the articles of the faith because God has revealed them, and then in light of those articles, the rest of your life begins to make far more sense and to be vastly more livable, right? Rationally and morally and humanly, right? So I just want to get that out at the beginning. Now, on the three issues that you raised, faith alone, Bible alone, and the nature of the Eucharist, well, you know, I could talk about these for an hour, but in a nutshell, the doctrine of faith alone is not biblical. It's not biblical, and nor is it historical. So you'll find, it doesn't matter who you are, Catholic, Protestant, or otherwise, historians of this issue fully recognize that the doctrine of faith alone didn't emerge in the history of Christianity until Martin Luther. It didn't emerge anywhere. So you're not going to find it in the Latin Church. You're not going to find it in the Greek Church. You're not going to find it in the Slavic Church. You're not going to find it in the Coptic Church. You're not going to find it in the Ethiopian or Eritrean Church. I mean, you don't find it in the Babylonian or Assyrian Church. Nowhere in the world where you have Christianity, whether you're reading the Bible in Greek or in Latin or in Coptic or in Syriac or whatever, do you find this emerge as a cardinal doctrine of the Christian faith until Luther?
Okay,
that's a clue that it ain't in the Bible. And it takes a very idiosyncratic reading of sacred scripture to get to it. Basically, you have to come at it through Luther's peculiar historical lenses. But, you know, the Bible teaches that we're saved by grace alone, which is something the Catholics also affirm, but not faith alone, not faith alone. I can go into those arguments in greater depth at another time. When it comes to the question of the Bible alone, again, the Bible doesn't teach that doctrine. The Bible teaches the contrary. The Bible actually teaches that Christ gave us the church as the rule of faith, never says he gave us the Bible. So the doctrine itself is self-refuting. And then finally, differences on the Eucharist. Biggest difference for Catholics and Lutherans on the Eucharist is Catholics regard the Eucharist as a sacrifice. Lutherans deny a sacrifice, which I should say Paul clearly teaches in his first letter to the Corinthians.
And Denny, thank you so much for your letter. In a moment, we'll talk with Ken in St. Louis, Susan in Pennsylvania. Three lines open right now at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Hey, glad you're with us for a Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Ken, a first-time caller from St. Louis, listening on the Great Covenant Network. Hello, Ken. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. Dr. Anders, I remember you saying that the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass and the Sacrifice of the Cross are the same sacrifice, but you made the distinction that they're not numerically one. I tried to make that same point in a class relative to the Catechism, paragraph 1367. I got a lot of pushback. I was wondering if you could talk about what that means to be not numerically one, and how do you go about proving to other well-formed Catholics that there's a distinction there.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. So the thing to do is to look at what the Church has actually positively affirmed in its dogmatic statements about the nature of the Mass and the nature of the sacrifice. And if you look at the Council of Trent in its session, session 22, that's right, chapter 2, they define the nature of the sacrifice. And this, of course, is just following Thomas's doctrine. So if you go to the Summa Theologica, Thomas will also give you this in his article on the Eucharist, on the nature of the rite, the subsection article on the rite, R-I-T-E, of the Eucharist. Thomas lays this out. And what St. Thomas says, what Council of Trent echoes, is that the Eucharist and the sacrifice of Calvary are the same in this respect, that the victim who died at Calvary is also present in the Mass. Right? The victim that died at Calvary is also present in the Mass. But he's not present in the same manner. So it's kind of like, as an analogy, this is just an analogy. Imagine a runner in the Olympics who runs a race and wins, right? And then he goes to the after party. And at the after party, they show a lot of films of his victory at the Olympics. Well, the same guy who ran the race is also present at the after party, but he's present in a different way, right? One, he's present as the runner in the race.
Yeah.
And the next one, he's present as, you know, commemorating that and receiving, you know, honor and laud and so forth. And they're running a lot of films showing his great victory. Well, there are differences, and I'm going to get into those from the analogy. It's just an analogy. But Thomas actually says on this issue, he says that it's the same victim. Jesus was there at Calvary, and he's here in the Mass through transubstantiation. But this is Thomas's language, not mine. He says, but the Mass is a sacrifice in the way that we say a picture of Cicero is Cicero. You see a picture on the wall and go, oh, that's Cicero. Well, not really. It's a picture of Cicero, okay? And in that way, the death of Christ, his actual bloody immolation, is not present literally in the Mass. What you have in the Mass is, don't get wigged out by this word, because he's not just symbolically present. He's really there through transubstantiation. But his death isn't really there. His death is symbolized through the double consecration of bread and wine. You have bread over here, wine over there, body here, blood there, body and blood in a state of separation. Present, represent, show forth, symbolize the death that took place once and for all at Calvary. And so the way the Council of Trent puts it is to say that the manner of the offering is different. Right? At Calvary, it was a bloody offering. But in the Mass, it's not a bloody offering. Right? It's the offering of Jesus' body and blood, because they're really there. But there's no immolation. There's no death that takes place. We don't kill him in the Mass. The fruit of Calvary is made present in the Mass. So the grace that he won for us, that's infused into us through the Holy Spirit, the forgiveness of sins, the renovation of life, those things were affected. Those things were won for us on the cross. They're made realities in our life through the Mass. And if you want a modern pope that has waxed long and eloquent about this, Pius XII's encyclical Mediator Dei is very, very explicit. It's extremely explicit on the way that the Mass is the same and the way that the Mass is separate from Calvary. They're the same because you have the same victim for the same purpose, namely to reconcile God and the world, right? But the manner of the authoring is distinctly different. And it was in commenting upon Pius XII's encyclical that the learned Catholic dogmatist and manualist Ludwig Ott, in his celebrated work Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma, discussing precisely the relationship between the Calvary and the Mass, uses the language of it is specifically the same but numerically distinct. Now, if that's where I get the terminology that I use in the show from, is specifically from Ott's commentary on Pius XII's encyclical. But a more sort of familiar way of expressing the same idea that every Catholic has knowledge of. Every time you go to Mass, the priest says, well, I'm going to offer this Mass for, and he states the intention, right? You can go to the church office and say, you know, my great-grandmother is having knee surgery on Thursday, and I'd like to offer a Mass for her healing. Or she didn't make it through knee surgery, so I want to offer a Mass for the repose of her soul. And you make maybe a $10 stipend or something, and the priest goes and says Mass for that intention. Well, take note that he can say Mass for one intention on Monday, and on Tuesday he says Mass with a completely different intention. And the way the Council of Trent deals with that is it says the Mass is itself, and he's talking about the particular rite celebrated on, say, Tuesday at 2 p.m., is a distinct oblation. Each individual offering of the Mass is a distinct oblation. That's why they are offered for different intentions, one on Monday, one on Tuesday, one on Thursday. And what has unfortunately happened, in my judgment, and a lot of sort of popular Catholic apologetics in the last 30 years, is that, yes, there's an emphasis on the Mass being a sacrifice, but it's entirely collapsed into the one moment upon Calvary in such a manner that the average Catholic no longer knows or no longer understands that there is, in fact, a distinction between the manner of offering that happened at Calvary and the manner of offering that happens in the Mass, whereas the Council of Trent is very specific that the manner of offering is very different. It's a very different mode of offering. So the way to emphasize this is to actually go to the language of the dogmatic statements. Now, the catechism, I don't have time to go in and do an exegesis of all the catechism. The catechism makes the very distinctions that I am making, but it also, and this is typical of the catechism on all the doctrines, the catechism has sections that are drawn as quotations from magisterial texts, from previous, you know, from sacred scripture, from conciliar statements, dogmatic definitions, and the like. But then it also has a kind of elaboration that draws on the language of popular piety and devotion and spiritual writing. And so interpreting the catechism and the instructions from the Holy See about how to do this are very explicit, requires some degree of nuance. You have to understand the kind of language the catechism uses and interpret it accordingly. So each proposition in the catechism is granted the weight ascribed to the source text from which it falls. So in other words, when the catechism quotes scripture, it's both inspired and infallible. When it quotes dogmatic definitions, it's infallible. When it quotes, say, canon law, theologians, and spiritual writers, it's maybe authoritative, but not necessarily infallible. In the same, so you have to bring these sort of nuances to bear. And if we had more time, or you and I were sitting down over a cup of coffee, I'd walk you through all the statements in the catechism and do the exegesis for you to show you how it lines up with the teaching of the fathers, with Thomas, with the Council of Trent, with the Catechism of Pius X, with the Encyclical of Pius XII, and so forth.
Ken, thanks so much for your call from St. Louis. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're watching on TV, you may want to send us an email for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Let's go to England now and talk with Matthew, who's listening online, ewtn.com. Hello, Matthew in England. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, are biblical scholars automatically authorities on theology as well? I used to think for a long time they were the same, but I've only been more and more surprised at some of the conclusions made by some scholars who are very well known in other Christian sects. And what prompted this call in particular was, there's a popular level commentary on the book of Revelation by one such scholar who's very well known on this side of the pond. And I know at the best of times, chapter 12 can be a bit of a battlefield, but for such a lauded expert to conclude that any mistaken reference to Our Lady is only a minority view based on a small verse or two, it went against even their own arguments made earlier in the other book when they referred to other figures like St. Michael and Satan, etc. And there was no attempt to even entertain the richness and the beauty of contributions to theology throughout history in that part of the text. So I just wondered, would it be fair to draw a distinction? Can someone be a great biblical scholar, yet draw contrary or incomplete theological conclusions?
All day long and twice on Sundays. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A person can be a very gifted biblical scholar. So the discipline of biblical scholarship has changed a lot over the years. And so the goals and aims of biblical scholars are not the same today that they would have been 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. But today, the way biblical scholarship typically works is, first and foremost, biblical scholars are historians. And they are attempting to arrive at the best manuscript traditions behind biblical passages to understand, what's the best we can do to discern what the original author actually wrote. They're trying to apply linguistic tools and archaeological tools and philological tools and comparative studies to understand the language that's being used. What do the words actually mean in their historical context? To try to situate biblical books within those historical contexts to make sense of what may be implicit rather than explicit. They're really how these texts may be received by the earliest Christians. They're really trying to do the work of historians, and that's incredibly important work. And I personally have continued to benefit enormously from the work of biblical scholars, whether or not they're Catholic, and I read their works. But that is not the same project that professional theologians are engaged in. Again, this is kind of a modern understanding, and that's the discipline changes over the years. But I'd say presently, the way, whether you're Catholic or not, with the way most Christians today, including the Holy See, would see it this way, understand the discipline of theology is the discipline of theology is about showing the coherence of the faith, both internally and with respect to what we can know reasonably about the world, to try to render the mysteries of the faith as intelligible as possible. And so one of the things that a theologian will do when engaging biblical scholarship is, let's say a biblical scholar draws a conclusion about the history of a text that contrasts a bit with the way the tradition has typically understood that very same question. The task of a theologian, for example, might be to assess, you know, whether the biblical scholar has made good arguments. And if the scholar in question has made good arguments, then to say, okay, so what kind of adjustments or entailments do we need to make to our understanding of the Catholic faith to accommodate this new information? And Pius XII, who wrote Divino Afflante Spiritu, which is the encyclical that gave Catholics the go-ahead to use higher biblical studies, makes this point explicitly, that access to historical information, archaeological data, and so forth, can enhance and deepen our knowledge of the Bible and can even reveal new things that we need to know that will enrich and deepen our faith. And the job of a theologian is to assess how that information is best assimilated into the Catholic faith to give us the most coherent, rational account of the faith that we can have. So the history of the Bible's use, the way the Bible has been understood in the Catholic faith, the way it's fed and nurtured the spiritual and moral imagination of Catholic people down through the centuries, is one of the data that you want to make use of. Biblical scholarship is only one part of the story, right? But the Bible, as sort of the center of the church's life of prayer and moral imagination, is a distinct piece of information that a theologian can't dismiss the way a biblical scholar might have to dismiss.
Mm. Matthew, thanks so much for your call from England. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Quick question here as we're going to break. This is from Tom watching us on Facebook today. Tom says, I've started smoking a pipe about a year ago. I was wondering if it is wrong to do so.
Okay, that's a really great question. And you're asking me now about my own private personal opinion, because the church as such has no doctrine on thou shalt smoke or thou shalt not smoke. But the sort of the root of Catholic moral theology is that we have a moral obligation to seek our own integral well-being and the integral well-being of other people. Integral means, you know, not just your soul, not just your mind, not just your emotions, not just your body, not just your social relationships, but all of those things integrally well-balanced so that you attain the optimal level of human flourishing, right? That's we have a moral obligation to seek happiness in a very deep and abiding way that connects us to God and other people lovingly, right? And our grasp of morality is rationally discerned. There's such a thing called natural law. What can we discern reasonably about the good of the human person in that integral sense? And what kind of obligations does that impose upon us? Now, my own personal opinion is that, say, prior to, 50, 60 years ago, no one understood the extent to which tobacco was harmful. And so you had lots of smoking priests, right?
Oh, yeah.
And smoking nuns, for that matter, too. And someone who takes up the habit and then can't kick it is in a very different position, in my opinion, from someone who takes up the habit today. And in my judgment, given what we know about the health risks involved, you go to your doctor, they'll say the one most reliable thing you can do to extend your life and improve your health is not smoke. I personally cannot arrive at the judgment it is a good idea for anyone to take up the habit of smoking. And to do so in spite of the evidence seems to me to be manifestly irrational when right reason is the rule of the virtuous life.
Tom, thanks for watching us on Facebook today. In a moment, we'll talk with Steve in Florida, Bobby in Michigan, Ethel in Kentucky. Lots more straight ahead on this edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-EWTN. 888-298-3986. Hey, congratulations going out to two more members of the EWTN radio family. WJPN in Dumfries, Virginia, celebrating 8 years with EWTN. Also, KEFA in Wenatchee, Washington, marking 10 years with us. Congratulations to David Morales at St. John Paul the Great Catholic High School in Virginia. That's where WJPN is. Also, Michael Drollman at Core Christi Academy in Washington State. From all your friends here at EWTN. All right, back to the phones now. Here is Steve in Florida, listening to us on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, Dr. Anders. Thank you for your ministry and calling. I'm a regular listener in Florida. But I had a question. Hypothetically, I'm not married, but if I had a Catholic family, would I have committed moral sin if my wife wanted to raise the family or the kids from her side, Protestant, mainly like Presbyterian, traditional Presbyterian?
Okay, thanks. Let me make sure I have the situation set up. So you're saying, let's say I'm Catholic and I'm married to a Presbyterian woman. We have children together, and my wife insists on raising the kids Presbyterian. Am I in mortal sin if I concede to that demand? Not necessarily. So the Catholic teaching on mortal sin is that for something to be a mortal sin, first of all, the matter in question must be objectively grave. And I would consider the question of the proper worship of God to be a grave matter, right? But that's only one criteria. The other two criteria are that, I need to be aware of the gravity of the thing. I have to really kind of have my eyes wide open about the thing. If I do something wrong, I do it with kind of impunity. And then the third criteria is that I'm not acting under compulsion, but I'm acting freely. And, of course, those second two criteria are impossible for anybody other than God to objectively evaluate, right? I can't stand here and make the judgment, you absolutely knew what you were doing, and you totally did it, like, with an uncompelled conscience. I can't know that. That's why we always leave the judgment of souls up to God. We don't pass judgment up. We tell people what's the objective right thing to do. But then we let God make the decision as to whether they're fully morally responsible for that. I would say that, you know, I used to be a Presbyterian, now I'm a Catholic. I wouldn't have made the change if I didn't think I had left the good for the better, right? I left the good for the better. And I wouldn't be a Catholic if I didn't have that judgment. So if you ask me, and I can give you all the reasons why later, if you ask me, you say, well, Anders, you know, if I go from Catholic to Presbyterian, how do you view that? Well, in my judgment, you've left the better for the not as good. You've left the good for the okay, right? And that's just that's the way moral choices work. You know, you choose a lesser good over a greater one. So yeah, I think if you choose Presbyterian over Catholic, you're choosing a lesser good over a greater one. However, I'm fully conscious of the fact that very many people who are connected to the Catholic Church don't actually grasp the better. Like the faith is not intelligible to them. They may have grown up Catholic. They may have gone to church all their life. They may have even gone to Sunday school or Catholic schools. But the Catholic faith doesn't make sense to them. They haven't had someone explain it to them in a way that grips their mind, their heart, and their soul in a way that sort of, you know, compels the obedience of faith, right? And because I know I went to church with these people, you know, folks that would leave the Catholic Church and say, well, you know, I went to the Catholic Church all my life, but I didn't know Christ and it didn't make sense to me. And then I went to this other church and it made sense. I get the force of that. And so, you know, I objectively, yeah, I think it's a move in the wrong direction. Subjectively, I understand that people can be in all kinds of degrees of attachment to the church and understanding, and so I wouldn't form that judgment. I'm just, you know, my position would be, if you come to me and you say, I'm Catholic, my wife wants to raise kids Presbyterian, I'd say, well, let's have a conversation. You know, let's get some spiritual direction. Let's take some counsel. Let's talk this thing out rationally. Let's try to come. You know, we want to have a good marriage. We got to keep the kids in a happy home. We don't want to have mom and dad constantly at loggerheads over religion. And let's see what we can discern about the best way to live out our religious life as a married couple. And I obviously think the Catholic way is the best. You don't agree with me on that, but let's charitably and lovingly try to work out some kind of solution that doesn't expose our kids to the danger of moral relativism, the idea that, well, nothing matters because mom and dad can't agree. And that's a danger. Whenever you have a mixed marriage and both parents, you know, practice their different religions with sincerity, is the kids step back and go, well, They can't figure this thing out, so obviously it doesn't matter what I believe. That's the danger in any kind of mixed marriage.
Steve, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Dr. Andrews and Mr. Matthew. Thank you very much for your ministry, sir.
Do appreciate hearing from you today. It's a Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on EWTN. Let's go now to Ethel, a first-time caller from Kentucky, watching us on EWTN television. Hello, Ethel. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Very well.
I just want to emphasize the fact that I'm a 92-year-old cradle Catholic, and I've been off through all this anti-Catholic stuff, from the time I was big enough to understand what was going on. Now, I really wonder at the Holy Father coming out on Fox TV saying that we should take in all the refugees and that we should not deny the refugees coming over the border. You know, what really upsets me is that we have the Holy Father speaking for the Catholic Church. We as Catholics know that the Holy Father does not make law in the church. But so many non-Catholics question this, and I say, why don't we have something behind that to explain that's his opinion?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I really appreciate it. So to clarify, there are absolutely laws that the Pope makes that are obligatory for Catholics, and those are called canon laws. So the law that governs the internal life of the Catholic Church, the things that you would find in the code of canon law, you better believe the Pope makes those, and you better believe Catholics obey them. But they're things like, how do you say Mass the right way? You know, how do you perform a baptism? What do you do if you have a fight with your bishop and you need to appeal to the Holy See? I mean, there are things that are internal to the life of the Catholic Church. Church positive law, ecclesiastical positive law. The Pope makes those laws. The Pope does not make the civil laws for all the nations of the world. So the Pope he doesn't make laws for the United States. He doesn't make laws. He doesn't even make laws for Italy, right, anymore.
Yeah.
Right? He makes laws for the Vatican City State, but he doesn't make laws all over the world, right? That's what individual governments and legislatures have to do. And the Church's teaching, and so to include the Pope's teaching, right? The Pope's teaching is that there is no ideology, not capitalism, not communism, not socialism, not distributivism, you name it. There's no sort of philosophy of law and social organization that just is the quote-unquote Catholic perspective, because all of those things are kind of time-bound and culture-bound and basically this-worldly in their orientation. They just don't encompass the truths of the human person and the life to come that is the essence of the Catholic faith. And so the Church doesn't endorse, as the Church, it does not endorse any of those, and to do so would really be to misstate the relationship of the Church to the world. Now, you might have it that a particular pope, in his private theological opinions, was like 100% sold out for free market capitalism. And so he might get up and make all kinds of addresses and really, urge people to go read, like von Mises and Austrian economics and let's get rid of all government regulations. And that would be an expression of his personal ideological opinions, but it wouldn't be an expression of the objective teaching of the Catholic Church. Or he might be a communist. Well, unlikely, but yet it's possible. He might be a socialist. He might be a distributivist. And he could quite literally pontificate all day from that point of view, and yet it wouldn't be the same thing as the Church's social doctrine. Now, what the Church does have is it does have a social doctrine. That is to say, it has a moral teaching about what constitutes the flourishing of societies. But those are never delivered in the form of policy initiatives. What they are is they're sort of moral absolutes. Things like, immigrants have dignity. They do. Immigrants have dignity. Families have integrity that should be respected. Those kinds of principles. But the working out, what does that principle mean in terms, but also as a moral teaching, like nations have a right to sovereignty and to control their borders. That's also true. Okay. And so in the United States, one of the differences that Catholics can have from one another, you can have Catholics that are all fully Catholic and they totally agree on the Catholic faith. And one Catholic says, hey, the Pope says that nations have sovereignty and their borders should be respected and they have a right to defend them. That's Catholic doctrine. Well, that's true. And then some other Catholic says, yeah, but he also says families should be kept intact and immigrants have dignity. So he should emphasize that. And so they can disagree with one another on the policy implications. You know, one tending more to open borders, one tending more to closed borders. That's a policy question, without ever disagreeing on the underlying moral principles. And so these are the kind of nuances you have to bring to bear on papal statements. When a pope stands up and he's not teaching dogma, He is commenting on policy, which he has a right to do. He can absolutely comment on policy. He totally has a right to do that. But the lay Catholic who's well catechized is able to draw the distinction between this is a Catholic dogma, this is a Catholic moral principle, and then this is a policy application. And when the church does intervene prudentially, when the pope intervenes, or your bishop or your priest or somebody intervenes prudentially, like if I go to Mass, you know, the priest can stand up and give his personal opinion on government policy. My job in the Mass is to go, well, you know, I may or may not agree with what the priest says in my Mass, but, you know, he's father and I'm not. He's the pastor and I'm not. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut and keep my opinions to myself. Like, I'm not going to stand up in the Mass and scream, you know, you raging ideologue, you.
Jacques.
Right, exactly. I'm not going to do that. Now, you know, now if I have father over for dinner and we're sitting there, well, you know, having a bowl of lentils or something together, well, we might get into it at an interpersonal level. And I could say, yeah, man, Father, I just really think you were out in the field on that one. You know, we could have a conversation. But I'm gonna give him the respect that he's due in the public sphere as my pastor. And The same thing holds with the Pope. If the Pope says something that I think that is not Catholic doctrine, it's just his personal opinion. Like on this radio show, for example, I'm not going to get into that. I'm not going to sit here and criticize the Pope's public statements. My job is to support the Church, and I have a religious submission in mind and will to the Holy Father and his authority, and I'm going to respect him. There's a time and a place and a forum for people who have the proper standing, like cardinals, for example, can share their opinions with the Pope if they think he's said something that needs to be clarified more. But that's for most of us, you know, we're not in that position, and so, you know, like Twitter feeds and YouTube commentaries and social media and all that is just airing our own opinions is probably not the best form for the dealing with those kind of questions.
Ethel, thanks so much for your call from Kentucky today. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Let me tell you about something beautiful now available from EWTN's religious catalog, and that is the Our Lady of Fatima Genuine Gemstone Rosary Bracelet. The special rosary bracelet was designed to tell the story of Our Lady of Fatima. It's handmade right here in the U.S. of A. The design uses a variety of semi-precious stones. A booklet is included that explains the significance of the beads and the metals. And alongside the Our Lady of Fatima medal is an angel, a reminder of the angel of Portugal that first appeared to the Fatima kids. A rose reminds us of the shower of rose petals that fell after the miracle of the sun. The crown symbolizes Mary's words to the children, "In the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph." And the bracelets, by the way, are stretchy, so one size fits most. EWTN's religious catalog has 30 different bracelet styles from which to choose. Visit EWTNRC.com to find your favorites. Again, available right now at EWTNRC.com. All right, back to the phones now. Here is Bobby. Bobby is a first-time caller from Michigan, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hey, Bobby, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I'm a new Catholic after being a Protestant for about 72 years.
Wow.
And just 3 years ago on Easter Vigil, I became a Catholic. And I do have some questions about a friend of ours has a daughter who became a son, and then she married a son that became a daughter. So the wedding, how does it between a man and a woman? My question is, what's the Catholic stand on that kind of marriage?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, first of all, let's deal with the underlying anthropology before we deal with the marriage. And the Catholic Church teaches that biological sex, which is binary in, you know, 99.999% of the cases, there are people that have strange chromosomal abnormalities where they don't completely develop according to, you know, whatever the proper morphology is in normal human development. And that's a kind of a handicap, just like somebody who's born blind or born deaf or something. And so it's a tragedy to be mourned and cared for, but it's not definitive of the nature of the human person. But in the vast majority of cases, human sexuality is binary. And that's a fundamental category, both personally in terms of my identity, as well as socially, meaning that it really is in accord with justice for society, not just the Catholic Church, but governments and cultures and rituals, to recognize and underscore, celebrate, hallow, and protect the sexual differentiation of men and women, because that's what is intrinsic to our need and desire to procreate and raise children, right? You got to have men and women to have babies and raise those children with mothers and fathers in families for the well-being and replenishment of society. And so it's a fundamental category. It comes into the life of the church, particularly in the sacrament of matrimony, because the sacrament of matrimony is not a ceremony to simply celebrate, say, you know, subjective erotic attraction. And to me, that's what marriage has become in the culture. Like, two people of whatever self-definition decide that they're kind of into one another, and they expect society to go, yay! And so marriage means nothing other than society's yay for two people who are romantically attracted. And that's just fundamentally not what marriage has meant to most cultures and most people for all of human history, and it's certainly not what the church means by it. Marriage is the institution whereby a man and a woman join in a lifelong indissoluble union for the sake of raising a family. Now, generally speaking, some kind of romantic attraction can help that process along, but it is not actually strictly necessary. So, you know, lots of arranged marriages between royalty, for example, in Catholic history, where for reasons family alignments and political alignments and for whatever reason, it would seem to be prudent for this couple to marry, even though maybe they didn't find one another the most attractive. And I remember I met a couple one time, a missionary couple, and this young man, he wasn't Catholic, but he was a Christian, and he felt called to a life of missions, and he was going to travel overseas and work in missions, and then and then he knew this young woman, and well, you know, doggone it, she was also called to a life of missions, and they came together and they said, you know what, we will be more effective as a Christian witness in the world if we're together than apart. And that was the basis of their union. You know, it was this decision to sort of align to this common mission of serving God and the church and their world, right? And they loved each other and all that, but it wasn't driven by the kind of sort of Hollywood stars in your eyes romance that everyone else seems to think is the essence of marriage. And like, they had the right idea, right? Because as you know, and I know, the stars in the ice thing doesn't last, right? Everybody gets old or they die. Right, and it kind of fades after a while, and something more enduring than that is necessary for the sanctity and the longevity of marriage. But anyway, that for that reason, that's what the church believes marriage is, and that's the way the church celebrates it. So the anthropology is connected to the institution of marriage. In my judgment, transgenderism is a religious movement. It's not fundamentally a scientific one. It's a religious movement because it has to do with a conception of the sacred, right? This is fundamental questions of identity and purpose and meaning and ethics and values and society, conversion. There's an orthodoxy. There's heresy. It's kind of like New England Puritanism, where the terms have been changed, right? But there's it begins from a kind of radically introspective declaration that, you know, there's something in my interior that no one else can see. It's not verifiable by anybody but me. It's sort of this inner sense of identity to which I have a kind of infallible access through introspection. And you are obligated to concede the truth of my introspection, right? Without any kind of criteria other than my own self-reporting. And my realization of this has a kind of quasi-religious character to it. My eyes have been opened. I've seen the truth. Now I'm liberated. I once was lost, and now I'm found. You know,
I see the parallel.
And then it forms a, you know, moral, and I put that in scare quotes, it forms a moral community, or a community that has a conception of what morality is in their case, and it's celebrating this kind of self-definition. And then it should in turn be imposed on society, right? And if you don't come along with this, then you're a heretic or an outcast, and you don't get a vote, right? And you're an evil, bad person. And of course, they have their heretics, and they have their orthodox, and they have their heresy trials and their witch trials and all of that. And but it's fundamentally grounded in what's not it's not scientifically or objectively observable, which is the self-reporting of someone's interior, utterly subjective experience of introspection, right? Which is that. There's no authority there other than that individual conscience.
Right.
Very similar to Puritanisms. conception that the sort of the basis for the gathered church in Puritanism was my self-report that I'm God's elect.
Mm.
I've told you that I'm converted. You know, I've met Jesus in my interior life as a Puritan, and you just have to agree with that. And on that basis, we're going to form a gathered church. And if you're outside, like Anne Hutchinson or somebody, we're going to burn you at the stake or run you out of Boston. And so it's very similar to early Christian Puritanism, right?
Fascinating.
Very different from the Catholic conception of conversion, I might add. Mm. And so it's a religious movement, basically. And we are all told that we have to go along with it. But I think we do so at great cost, right, to the dignity of the human person, to the freedom of religion, for that matter, and to the institution of marriage. And so the relationship you've described is just not what Catholics mean by marriage. Now, the irony here is what you've said is you actually have a biological man and a biological woman, like, who have pledged themselves to one another, right? But they're confused about who's who, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know that this has ever been adjudicated in a canon law tribunal, but my sense is that they can't be intending what the Catholic Church means by marriage, right? Well, maybe they are, but like, so for the Catholic Church to recognize a marriage, the couple involved, at bare minimum, must intend the procreation of children through sexual union. And so, you know, whatever you call it, like the biological male must intend for the biological female to become pregnant through sexual association, and the biological female must intend the same thing. Like, there's so many unanswered questions here, but it on the surface, it is not what church means by marriage.
This is why we have seatbelts, by the way, here on the set. We have the seatbelts so that we can, like, okay, I understand. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate that, Bobby. Let's go now to Zach in St. Louis, listening on the Great Covenant Network. Hey there, Zach. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, how many Catholic saints are there?
Oh, yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Well, I think I'll take a quote from Carl Sagan.
Okay.
Billions and billions, right? There are vastly more Catholic saints than any of us will ever know or be able to count, is the answer. Now, you may, if by saint you mean everyone who is in heaven that enjoys the vision of God, that's an uncountable number. And
yeah.
And Scripture says, you know, we, myriad upon myriads and thousands upon thousands, and we don't even know. If you're talking about canonized Catholic saints, saints who are publicly recognized as such and have entered into the church calendar and have a sort of public cult and veneration, well, that's a finite number. And I can't tell you off the top of my head, but, you know, something like Butler's Lives of the Saints, for example, gives
sure.
you kind of a bird's eye view of saints, at least within the Latin tradition. It doesn't include Eastern Catholic saints. And then, of course, we've had a lot of canonizations since then. But, I mean, it would be, I mean, this is, I'm just pulling this number out of my head. I can't verify this. But, I mean, I would say in the tens of thousands.
Okay.
But lots.
There you go, Zach. Thanks for your call from St. Louis. Here is Ann now in southwestern Michigan, watching us on EWTN television. Ann, we just have a minute here. What's on your mind today?
My mind?
Yes, ma'am.
Whether I should attend a family member's non-Catholic wedding.
Yeah, thanks. Is the family member in question a Catholic?
She was baptized, but she's not practicing.
When did she stop practicing? Do you know?
I'm not that close with the family, and I don't think she even practiced as a child growing
up. So if we're talking about someone who was baptized as a Catholic but was never fully incorporated into the church, maybe didn't even receive First Holy Communion, didn't go to reconciliation, then this is a person whose whole religious formation has been outside the Catholic faith. And so, yes, technically, canonically, this person is a Catholic, but I don't see how your refusal to go could have the effect of winning her back to the Catholic faith, right? Because she has no context to understand your action and would almost entirely likely to see it as a kind of bigotry, right?
Mm.
She wouldn't be able to interpret the positive motive involved, you know, your desire to see her reconciled to the church and God and to live a fully Catholic life. I mean, those goals are unintelligible to her right now. And in my judgment, you're probably better served by trying to build a relationship with her than by utterly alienating her from the start.
And thanks for watching us on EWTN television, and thanks to for your call today from Southwestern Michigan. Fast-moving show today, I would say. Dr. David Anders, thank you,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
We do this program Monday through Friday on EWTN Radio. You can check us out live Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available for your consumption at EWTN.com/radio. Once you're on the radio homepage, click on Podcast Central and go click on that. You are good to go. On behalf of our fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a great day and God bless.